I wonder, I agree with you that actually, you know what you think about this, because that might be a difficult question. Do we Christians, do Muslims worship the same God? I mean, is it the God of Abraham, or is it, do we think, should we think of the Trinitarian God, the God of our Father, of our Lord Jesus Christ? Which way should we go? How should that help us?
I think I stand by it. Yes, it's a difficult one. I mean, let me just clear away some of the undergrowth before I leave you. Words can be given new content and new meaning. So, for instance, the word Allah is, as Faraz will tell you no doubt, it's the ordinary Arabic word for God. And so Arab Christians use that word for God. It is the word normally used in the Arabic Bible and in the worship of the church. But of course they give it Christian content. I mean, they don't just use it, they also give it new content. And this has ever been so. Even in the New Testament, the word used for God, theos, is the word that was used by the Greeks for their pagan God. But it is given Christian content, so used. In the missionary history of the church, this has always been the case. I was reading a study some time ago of 17 African cultures and what happened when the Christian faith came to them. Well, lots of interesting things happen, but one of the things is that the word for God is, in every case, the word for the supreme being that is used by that culture for the coming of the gospel to them. So that's one set of observations. The other is that the Bible teaches that human beings have some knowledge through creation and conscience of their Creator. They have distorted and obscured that awareness, but it is there. No one, as St. Paul said in this term, no, God has not left himself without witness anywhere. So, of course, when we speak of the Muslim conception of God, there are certainly elements in it that have to do with the God who created the world and the God who makes us aware of Him inwardly. But it is not, from our point of view, an adequate conception of God. It may even be, in some respects, anti-Christian, where it denies, for instance, God as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. By the way, I mean, this is a true story. I was talking to a very senior Ayatollah in Iran some years ago, and as so often happens in the Muslim world, he suddenly, apropos of nothing, said to me, he said, but you believe in the Trinity, don't you? And I said to him then, and I will say it again, I said, what the Quran condemns, we do not believe. Because what the Quran condemns is a misunderstanding of what Christians believe about the Trinity. So it is very important to give people a right account of what Christians actually believe, because they may have a complete misunderstanding from a missionary point of view, and this is not just a Muslim, but anyone, you have to begin with where people are, and then to bring them to a fuller knowledge. We talk of secular Britain, but it's not secular really. People have all sorts of strange ideas about God, but no doubt parish priests come across. Well, many of those ideas are wrong, but you can't begin by telling them it's wrong. I mean, you have to begin with connecting with them and then bringing them to the wholeness of truth in Jesus Christ.
it was when you were talking about radical Islamism. And one of the rules of any faith or what color is that they have a belief that they have the right answer, and I think it's right to stick to that and wrong to be reflective on it. How do we engage with, you know, and I'm certainly not just talking about Muslims here, with people who don't want to be reflected from what they believe is right, so how can we take it and move away from it?
Sounds to me like the subject of your new book.
Yes, the people I've come across most recently who are like that are the aggressive secularists. I mean, you know, they will not see that there is another point of view at all, because they have arrived at a particular view and you try and shift them. Even their own evidence doesn't convince them. As I tried to do with Richard Dawkins some weeks ago on Newsnight. I think that, I mean, what you say is true, but the thing about radical Islamism is that it is a bit like Marxism. It is a radical and totalitarian ideology. There's no part of life that is left outside. Families, children, personal conduct, relationships, all fall within its remit. And so I think, you know, I relate to Muslims as people who have a particular faith and devotion and prayer life and all that. That's fine. You know, that's exactly how it ought to be. But Islamism is not just a faith. It is an ideology. It's a political, social, economic ideology. And you have to deal with it at that level where it is... Sometimes it is just a question not of dealing with what they believe, but gaining fundamental freedoms for people who may be under their influence. Where Islam is concerned, not radical Islam, I think in the Muslim world, certainly, we have to argue for freedoms that can be justified by Muslims for themselves. I mean, that is the only kind that will have any impact. So, in the dialogue with Al-Azhar that I was talking about, one of the subjects was the punishment for apostasy. You know, the traditional punishment for apostasy from Islam is death. Now, if we are going to get Muslims to say this is not appropriate, it has somehow to be justified from within their own system. And the Al-Azhar scholars were moving towards that position by saying, for instance, there is no punishment for apostasy in this life in the Quran. That it is a later tradition, it's a weak tradition, it ought to be revisited and so on. Well, we can't judge what they do, but we can certainly judge the results of that study. They have to do that in the integrity of their own situation. I was talking to senior Shia cleric in Islam in Iraq, and he said that the relationship between revelation and reason in Shia Islam is such that he thought it was perfectly possible for the Iranian Majlis, the parliament, to declare that there should only be that a man should be allowed to marry only one wife. Now, I can't make a judgment on that, you know, as a Christian. But if it leads them to that conclusion, then that's a conclusion I'm quite happy to live with. You see what I mean? So I think you have to follow a number of different strategies for the sake of freedom for people and for societies, in fact. But radical Islamism has to be identified as an ideology, more than just a faith.
Just a comment here, I was involved in that event. But our mind is a very modern man. And he says the Irish one is a pioneer problem.
Basic view. But to take, it was not just Archbishop Rowan, it was also the when the law was used to sit, of course, there was a supreme court in this land until recently. And when they sat to pronounce on appeals, the bishop sat with them. It happened, the bishop on duty in the House of Commons. And I was on duty in one of the large cities, as the law was. When they were deciding an appeal by a Lebanese woman against deportation to Lebanon, and they ruled in her favor because they said that if this woman is deported to the Lebanon under Sharia law, her son will be taken from her and given to her husband. And this, they said, would be a violation of her fundamental rights. Now, this is exactly almost just a few days after the Lord Chief Justice had said in East London Mosque that Sharia family law should be recognized in this country. So you're saying it would violate a woman's fundamental freedom in Lebanon, but you're willing to recognize it here. I mean, how does that square? I think both of these eminent gentlemen put forward family law as the acceptable face of Sharia. I mean, what they were saying was, we are not talking about Sharia punishments like cutting off the hands and all that. That's not what we're talking about. But what about Canada? Now, all right, let's take Canada. What would happen? At the moment, bigamy is a crime in this country. If you recognize Sharia family law, would it be a crime only for some? And not for others? What happens to one law for all? What about divorce? In Western public law, the parties in the divorce are recognized as equal. That is intrinsically not the case in Sharia law, where a man divorces in one way much easier, and a woman can obtain a divorce by a much harder process. What about the custody of children? Well, I've already given you the example of the Lebanese woman. The presumption is that after a child attains the age of reason, the custody goes to the father. Well, this is contrary to much judicial practice, certainly in this country at this time. The laws of inheritance are unequal. So, women are discriminated against, and non-Muslims cannot inherit from Muslims. So, if a son, for example, becomes a Christian in a Muslim family, he cannot, by definition, inherit from his father. The laws of evidence discriminate between men and women, between Muslim and non-Muslim. So how would you, what I'm saying is, you would introduce principles of contradiction in the body of law. This is highly understandable. This is not just about well-meaning, soft-focused liberalism. I mean, we would be in a situation that Muslim countries are in.
Whether there was equal police protection in this country. Well,
said, ah, it is the cause of right now in Ukraine. He said, ah, he said, the right Reverend President is talking about our respect for culture. So I said, what does that mean? Does that mean that if a Muslim Asian woman, for example, is beaten up at home, somehow finds her way to the police station, the police summon the community liaison officer who takes the threat back home and they get beaten up again? I mean, that cannot be permitted under principles of British justice. So, freedom for people to practice their faith, recourse for all of British justice, and protection for them, particularly women, but and imagine other people. There is, I think, the issue of how far you respect conscience, how far law respects conscience, whether the Christian or for Muslims, or indeed others. And I have been trying to promote with the Attorney General the idea of reasonable accommodation, which has been developed in the United States, where an employer or a service provider must respect the religious beliefs of a person if that does not jeopardize the viability of the business or whatever it is being done and does not cause undue burden on other employees. So, if Muslims want to pray at set times, for instance, that ought to be provided for, if it can be done reasonably without disrupting a place of work or a business or whatever. But that is quite different from recognizing Sharia in terms of the public office and they are the substitute.
Dialogue, do you think that it is a helpful procedure in dialogue with Muslim people to try to pick up what the Quran says about Jesus and use that as a jumping off point for discussion about Jesus and how he relates to us today?
Yeah, no easy answers. You see, on the one hand, the Quran denies some very important truths about Jesus. And it misunderstands other truths that I've just said. On the other, there is more about Jesus in the Quran than almost anyone else. So there are two different accounts of his birth, there's an account of his miracles, he's called the Messiah, he's called Word of God, whatever that might mean. The institution of the Eucharist is described in a sort of way. I mean, you know, there's a great deal. And it is certainly possible to talk about those things. As long as we don't just endorse what you might call the Muslim Jesus, because in important respects, the Muslim Jesus has become different even from how Jesus is described in the Quran in the course of history. And, I often say there are three aspects to the Muslim Jesus. You have, first of all, the Jesus of the Quran. The interest of the Quran in Jesus is mainly doctrinal, who he really is and what he's not. Then in the Hadith, in the traditions about the Prophet of Islam, the interest is mainly eschatological. What will Jesus do when he comes back? So mainly convert Christians to Islam, break down the crosses. You see the breaking down of the crosses in the British cemetery in Tripoli. It's not an accident. I mean, it was not vandalism. It was a deliberate, this is what will happen. So he will break down all the crosses as any good Muslim should, and then lead everyone in prayer behind Muhammad. So the interest is eschatological. And then the Sufis, the Islamic mystics, have quite a different view of Jesus. They see him as the ascetic par excellence who has given everything up for God and should therefore be emulated. So, yeah, different ways to
think of, I mean, depends who you're talking to.
You can talk to people that haven't
asked questions, that's fine.
We talked a lot about different religions and about law. I'm not a lawyer, but I realise that lots of layers have to be stripped off first. But I am a biological scientist, and I'm very interested in the suggestion that there might be a God gene. I don't know if you'd like to comment on this, and whether perhaps because of different nationalities and different religions emerging, that this might be due to our DNA.
Yes, thank you. I mean, I was alluding, of course, to Professor Dawkins' idea of the me rather than the gene, which some mythical entity that jumps from brain to brain and perpetuates religion. But, the idea that the spiritual is deeply wired into us, maybe even physiologically, was something that the Alistair Hardy Institute did a great deal of research on. I think it is also true, and I think that to be fair to Professor Dawkins, he probably accepts this, that religion has contributed also to the survival of human species. If it has, then you can't say it's wholly harmful, on his own people. I think, biological scientists, of course, ask questions framed according to their own discipline, of course, but I think the wider question has to be asked, which is, how is it that there are creatures now who can look at the universe and themselves and ask these sorts of questions? How did that come to be? And I was asked to preach. Charles Darwin used to live in the Diocese of Rochester. So I was asked to be the preacher at the bicentennial of his birth. A great occasion with scientists and the Darwin family, many of whom are practicing Christians, as his wife was, who came. And so I said, well, Darwin, of course, was very impressed with the conflict in nature, and that's true. But there are other things to notice. I mean, there's also cooperation. And some work on human cells these days by people like Lynn Margulis have shown that this cooperation may not just be, you know, between zebras and birds that sit on them and tick that ticks, but actually be in material within the cell itself. I mean, you will know more about that than I do. There is then what Professor Simon Conway Morris has called convergence. That is to say that widely separated creatures produce very similar organisms. Because evolution, he says, has a tendency to find the best way forward. Well, you may not call that the argument of design, but it's not 100 miles away from it. Then there is what Tarhal or Chardin called complexification. So the course of evolution is complexified, isn't it, all the time, from the simple to the complex. And then there is this disruption, if you like, which has never really been accounted for, of consciousness. The birth of consciousness. And then the birth of self-consciousness. Now all of this needs to be accounted for. Not just in terms of the gene, but the whole nature of the universe itself.
No, I'm just leaving space in case there were people that hadn't asked but wanted to.
I think this is perhaps going backwards a bit. In relation to what you said today about Sharia law and UK law, how do you think this works in a situation such as the one we have where a US soldier has committed a crime in Arabic
another one is the Nirvana Sun we're talking about. On the one hand, when a soldier commits an offense, that soldier is tried through court-martial by the armed forces. I suspect that is what is happening to this man. I suppose the question is, should he have been court-martialed in Afghanistan? But again, it would have to be by his own army. I can't see any instance of a soldier being handed over to a civilian power in a situation of war.
But why is soldiers different from members of the religious community?
Oh, I see what you mean, yes.
If we're saying that the Muslim woman should be free to not be carved by Lord Sharia courts, why should the soldier not be compelled to be carved by the laws allowing him to commit a crime, rather than, some people might say, hiding behind the court martial because he knows he won't receive the punishment in, well, I don't know, he might see the best sentence. But if we want safety in this country, people are judged by British law. Why in other countries are people who are there committing crimes under their legal system not tried by their law?
To answer that last one first, I think it is very doubtful that if an American soldier committed a crime in Britain, that he would be handed over to the British court. I think he would be tried by the American army. But what I'm saying about Sharia is not that Muslims should not be allowed to practice Sharia. Of course, as Muslims, they will. That is part of the freedom of religion that we are talking about for them. What I'm saying is two things. One, that Sharia should not be recognized as public law in this country because of the contradictions that are involved. And secondly, that anyone, whoever it may be, must have recourse to British courts for British justice in this land. Now, you are saying, would that apply to an American soldier in Britain? I think the answer is probably not, and that's a fair enough question.
I think this will be the last question.
We may lose something, of course. saying, there was a very distinguished but very shy Archbishop of South Africa at one time called Selby Kelly. And he was invited to speak to the Mother of Union.
It's a lot of bishops.
To put them at their ease and also to put himself at ease, he said, as he began his address, he said, ladies, I would like you to know that underneath this cassock, you and I are exactly the same. Now, it's not my job, and that's not just about my other job. This is about motivation, about what drives people, about priorities, about relationships. Carol Gilligan, the well-known feminist educationalist, has shown how women's moral development is different from men. That men emphasize autonomy more and more,
which may account for some of our difficulties,
whereas women emphasize interdependence more. Now, if that is the case, then women have something huge to contribute to moral development that men have not. And indeed, men also may have things. We are now seeing more recognition that boys at a certain age are much more adventurous and wanting to do things that girls don't want to do at that age. Whereas girls are more skilled at certain tasks than boys are. So now, what do you do? Do you press everybody into the same mode and say, everyone's the same? So what I'm saying is equality does not mean sameness. I think this is something that ought to be recognized. Now, coming to your question, I have ordained women. I appointed the first woman archdeacon in the Church of England. But I do believe that we have asked the wrong question. We ask the question that we asked, and I'm involved in this as much as anyone, was basically, we wouldn't admit it to ourselves, but it was basically, how can we press women into a male model of ministry? Which is what we've done. I mean, the model, the pattern of ministry in the Church of England were developed over hundreds of years for men. And all we've done is, and there are huge cultural issues that are arising from this, for women, as well as for others. I think what we should have done was to have asked, what kinds of ministries is God calling women and men to? And then to have answered that in its own integrity. I think some women also wanted to be like men. Robert Runcie once sent, I was an assistant at one time, and he sent me, used to give me some difficult things. He sent me off to meet the National Women's Caucus of the Episcopal Church. And in all innocence, I went up to meet him. And then some American learned that I was going to do this. They said, "Are you mad? You know, they will eat you alive." And clearly, these were women who had seen men get on in a particular way and wanted to be like them. Well, maybe that's necessary in a generation also. But I think in the end, and being frank here, I think the answer is not impressing women into male models of ministry, but for men and women both to ask, what are the ministries to which God is calling us? And then to equip them in the integrity that God has given them as women and men for the purpose.
Bishop Michael, we have ranged far and wide this evening, much further and wider than I suspect either you or I anticipated. But you have given us a great deal to think about, and we are enormously grateful both for your sharing and for your time this evening.